It's not just about I'm passionate, I'm getting my intuition, but it could be like, this is where my skill sets can play in the market right now. This is what I know about myself, and this is the first pass. This is as best a guess as any for me to start, and this is what I'm going to do. And so when I'm making that transition in anything in life now, which I've gone from basketball to capital markets to real estate developer to venture capital, when going back to evergreen skills, it goes back to self-awareness.
Welcome to the Zero Quit Podcast, where I bring you candid conversations with elite athletes, entrepreneurs, specialists, and other creatives. I'm your host, Brock Covington, and through these dialogues, you will hear powerful stories and practical advice that will help you live a more active and intentional life. If you enjoy the show, be sure to subscribe and share it with a friend. What's going on, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Zero Quit Podcast. Today, I have on Ty Morris. He is a real estate developer, athlete, and father of two. After finishing 4 years of D1 basketball at Boston College, he spent 3 years overseas playing in basketball in Europe, Romania, right?
Yeah.
And since
Romania.
Then, good old Romania. And then since then, he's transitioned his leadership and his teamwork skills and all that into the business world with real estate, wealth management, and a whole lot more. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Yeah,
have to be in your humble abode.
Yeah, no,
beautiful
this is
home.
Great. Show it off a little bit. We have a ton of construction going on in the backyard. There's drills and hammers, but Brock
can
promise
spot.
Me that we won't hear any of it for you guys. So
exactly.
No, excited to have you, man.
Yeah. So one thing we were discussing right before I started the cameras was you don't have breakfast. So before we get into anything, I got to know, what's the deal with that?
Yeah, dude. So it's kind of a long story, but playing basketball, fitness, wellness, all that had been a priority at some level. I mean, you can't completely negate what you're putting into your body if you're going to be an athlete of any sort. Now, there's levels to that, as we know, and different commitment to diet and routine. For me, when I was playing, it was always a secondary factor. The workouts were primary. Sleep was probably ahead of nutrition, and then nutrition was just an afterthought. It was more like fuel. And when I was in college, no problem. I mean, you basically put anything in your body, which now you know is probably not the best way to go about it. But when I was there,
convenience,
the nutrition and the science around nutrition, we didn't have a nutritionist. We didn't have anybody managing our meals. There was no like training table in that. It was just, hey, go to the dorm, get your meal, right? Or hit McDonald's on your way back to the dorm. Convenience, as you said. All right, so you fast forward to Europe, and I get to my first year in Romania, dead of winter, and I don't speak the language. And there's really two camps in Romania. Interesting country. So for most people here in the U.S., you may or may not know this, but communism was basically the route of Romania up until 1989.
Was it? It was a Soviet state. Is that correct?
Yeah. And then broke away, and then Ceausescu was overthrown in 1989 by this like younger contingent of individuals in the country that needed and wanted change. What was interesting about the country when I arrived was you could still tell the dichotomy between both sides, where you had this old faction of folks in Romania that were very traditional in nature. You know, self-sustaining farming communities, horse and buggy was still like primary way of making their way around the countryside or the city. And then you had this new kind of modern, hip, younger, college-going contingent of folks in there that wanted, it was like 1990s urban American culture.
That's funny you mention that, because my only, or it's not my only depiction of Russia, but a depiction of started to think about when I think of the culture has been very much impacted by reading a lot more Dostoevsky and Tolstoy over the past year or so. And one thing I never really realized is that where Western Europe and America was obviously changing very much the Industrial Revolution and really got away from serfdom and this rural living pretty early in like the 1800s.
Yeah.
Russia was very late to that game.
Oh yeah,
where they had, you know, serfdom and landowners versus, you know, people that didn't own land. Like that was a very clear distinction for a very long time. So it's interesting that you make that distinction, that there was still that kind of growing and like factioning basically between the population, that even like it still exists like today.
Oh, but big time. I mean, there's one story which is horrific, but paints the picture that I'm trying to paint. On the way to a game in a town called Ploiești outside of Bucharest, one of the buses of the opposing team hit a horse, killed the horse, And I've never seen a man, grown man, cry so hard. Because and on the surface, it's like, okay, it's just the horse. But that was his everything. That was his mode of transportation. Yeah. That was how he was getting work done on his farm. And so real time, I mean, you'd have the nicest of nicest European cars and wealth right next to what you were explaining as serfdom, like people that were using the land, livestock, in a way that they used it 100, 200, 300 years ago. Very interesting dichotomy in the country. So I go over there in my first year and everything is brown. What I mean by that is like beige browns were like the color of the rainbow on your plate. You had schnitzel, all everything, potatoes, rice, and no greens. And a lot of processed foods as well on the road. So I gained like 15 pounds that first season. I was a big boy. I was like
You're like James Harden.
I was like 207. I was like James Harden when he's trying to get traded.
Yeah.
That's like, I took the James Harden route. So I was a big boy. And I mean, to the point where like these guys were calling me fat for the first time in my life. Yeah. I had never been called fat.
You're a guard, right?
I was a guard. Yeah. I looked like a fullback. And and the thing I loved about the European guys that I was playing with is that they were, I mean, direct as direct can be. Like, like pinching your stomach, like you got a little extra there, right?
There's no body positivity.
Stuff that in the U.S. they would never say.
Yeah.
So I really started to look into, that was the first season of the shift, I'll call it, in my nutrition, where I was focused on what I was putting in my body. Not to say I was counting calories, but I was just cognizant when I was eating, how I was feeling, using it as fuel, but not indulging as much as I had when I was overseas. And when I went back for my second year, I learned how to cook, which my wife, Alex, will tell you was the way that I got her to eventually marry me. And now I don't cook at all. So anyway, she has mixed feelings about that. But I come back in the second year, I drop like 20, 25 pounds and I'm lean. And that's as good a shape as I'd ever been in my life, including college. Felt really good. So, okay. Done playing basketball, injuries knocked me out. Now I'm back in, call it the working world. I'd gone on a stint with my first company that I started working for after basketball. Had worked my way back to Indianapolis where my parents lived. And my dad was sick with cancer, lymphoma, and was basically stage 4 cancer. So I spent the last like 3 or 4 months of his life with my real estate development partners, kind of taking him up to Mayo Clinic, taking him to the University of Chicago Hospital, trying to find solutions for his lymphoma. Unfortunately, we didn't find a solution in time. He ended up passing away. And his story of nutrition is like most stories of nutrition in the Midwest. He wasn't a drinker, which is somewhat of an anomaly in the Midwest. I mean, most people are drinkers. But what he was like a 3-square meal, meat and potatoes guy. And that was healthy nutrition. As long as it wasn't McDonald's and it was 3 square meals of like the basics, you felt like mashed potatoes, your beef cutlet, like your chicken, you were doing just fine. Like, I'm not eating fries and burgers every night, so I must be doing just fine. Well, he had a triple bypass with his heart. He was a type 2 diabetic. And he ended up passing away from cancer. So for me, it was like you hear the triple threat and you're like, okay, what's actually going on here? The other thing that was astonishing about that for him was most people knew him as very active. He played basketball a couple times a week for a guy in his early to mid 60s. Like, it was pretty impressive that he was still out there doing it, but not the healthiest with what he was putting into his body at the end of the day. So when he did pass away, it made me reconsider a lot, not just the nutrition in life, but when it came to nutrition, I started to focus on, am I still doing enough in this regard? And one of the areas that I knew I had problems with was my A1C levels, my blood sugar levels, and controlling those, that movement. For A1C is like your average tracking blood sugar in your blood system. So I started to read some research on intermittent fasting back when this was like kind of early days for doing that. And some of the studies that were coming out, whether controlled, uncontrolled, we can like get into that, were showing some promise of like either reducing body fat, helping people maintain healthy weight. And for me, what it came down to when I started eliminating breakfast, back to the initial question, was it made my choices throughout the day more simple, and it condensed them. where when I'm in the business world, if I don't have to think about eating breakfast and I just have to consider two different meals when I'm eating out, help me simplify the options that I had and lessen the mental gymnastics that I was playing. So when I started that habit, I was able to maintain healthier body weight and reduce my body fat and increase performance. And I just stuck with it. Now, I kind of pride myself on being flexible in my thoughts and like changing my mind. And a lot of the data that's come out recently is, well, intermittent fasting is kind of just the tool to reduce calories throughout the day.
Yeah, that's how I usually perceive it.
Yeah, yeah. It's not necessarily doing anything metabolically for you, which, again, even if that is the case, and it probably is, I'm still...
Still a tool.
Yeah, it's still a tool for me to help me maintain the goals or maintain traction towards the goals that I want to have, right? So I've just stuck with it, and occasionally on a Saturday, if I'm whipping up pancakes for the boy... I'll eat a few, but generally speaking, yeah, we've been going on 5, 6, 7 years of no breakfast.
Yeah, I like that you said that. Just because diet is very dogmatized lately, yeah. Where it's like it's like one way or another. Or, oh, vegan works for me, or intermittent fasting works for me, and yeah, people are very they're negligent to, or they resist looking at anything that's contrary to what they've been doing. So it's nice that you still like. Have that sense of self-awareness to recognize that about yourself and be like, okay, you know, I do want to remain or maintain this flexible mindset. So I need to, you know, recognize that, but I can still leverage it as a tool.
You do that as well though.
Yes. Yes.
That's one of the things that I admire most about you, I think, is like your openness to like maybe not going far right, far left, but like exploring what's between.
Yeah. Well, it's like an old, phrase. One guy I used to be, friends back in Virginia used to always say, I don't turn nothing down but my collar. So it's kind of like the idea of like,
dude, yeah, straight up.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to keep an open mind. I think that allows you to kind of be flexible because things aren't always so certain. But going back to the idea of living in Romania, so you mentioned you were there for what, 3 years, right?
Yeah. Give or take.
Give or take?
Two,
okay.
Yeah. 2.5, 3 years.
What went into your decision to play overseas? Because you spent 4 years at Boston College, D1 program, and you know you may not have the option to go NBA. But I always wonder, you know, what is that experience and what goes into that decision to say, okay, well, I still want to play. I have this opportunity overseas. You know, what made you go that route instead of just transitioning already into, let's say, work life here in America?
Yeah, it was just the passion. It's kind of like wringing the last drop of water out of the washcloth.
Yeah,
still there. Yeah. And, but truth be told, like I was very close to not going to play. When I graduated from college and I hired an agent, there were a lot of summer training, weekends and tryouts, early team tryouts for the Pacers, which they have probably like a handful to 10 a summer where they'll bring in different guys that either didn't make the summer league or whatever and just put them through a workout to see if there's anything there. There's a lot of European pro tryouts where they'll fly you into Vegas and make you play a couple scrimmages and go through some workouts there. So there was a lot of that post-college. And I hired an agent that was a friend of mine and my father's in Indianapolis. And what happened that summer was he had me earmarked to go to a team in Slovakia. To the point where, like, I don't think he did a lot of work outside of that one team and tried to get me placed, because every conversation that I had with him was about that one team in Slovakia, and there's however many countries there are in the world and a bunch of different leagues, and I was thinking there has to be at least one other option out there. And so it became, I became very skeptical of the conversations and came to find out that that was where he had me earmarked and thought it would be a great first location for me, but I didn't want to go. So I fired him and kind of moved on. But what happens is if you miss that summer window to get placed on a team, this is in the NBA or in Europe, you're kind of out. If you miss the European window, you're sitting out for that first half of the season. If you miss the NBA window, sometimes you can get picked up by a European team, but you may not have your first choice of where you would have gone in Europe had you gone a little bit earlier. But I had to go that first fall half of the season without a team. And during that half, I was basically said, I'm going to go into the working world. But this was 2009, off the heels of 08-09.
Yes.
Yeah. So you graduate with a degree in finance.
Mm-hmm.
They're walking people out of the offices. They're not bringing them in, particularly ones that don't have basically perfect resumes with a million extracurriculars that are going to be the next president, right? Those were like the only types of people getting jobs. I was not that. My road trip up and down the East Coast from Boston to New York to try to find a job, sleeping on couches, going out with friends at night, getting interviews through mentor connections, just didn't work out. I was coming back to Indianapolis and had an interview with a guy that ran money at a shop called Wells Capital Management. I'll never forget it. While I was going to interview with him, that caught in a 2 to 3 week stint, I had been playing pickup basketball with a friend of mine who knew an agent in Philadelphia. And had not to my knowledge, I didn't know anything about this. He had sent him a tape and had asked him if there are any teams looking for a point guard overseas because he had been playing with me and said I was still in shape. I'm walking into this interview and I get a call on my cell phone from a Philadelphia number and I pick up and it's this agent. And he's saying, basically, you have a 10-day tryout with this team in Romania and you got to decide in 3 days if you're going to go and play. So I walked in, had this interview. Basically, at the end of it, this guy and I both decided I wasn't a fit for him and I should definitely go and take this opportunity. And I had decided that this wasn't a fit for me and I should go take this opportunity. So packed my bags and 3 days flew to Romania and made the team on a 10-day tryout, and the rest was history.
Seems like a quick, obviously it was a quick decision. And it seemed like for at least a time you weren't fully sold on that this was going to still be a reality. Was part of the decision just a kind of denial or rejection of your current state, like where you were at currently with your life, like upset with how things were currently going, and the difficulty, again, as you're referencing it, as you know, the state of the current market at that time? Was it more a matter of, well, whatever's going on here isn't working, I might as well take this opportunity? Or was it more so the allure of the opportunity itself?
Probably a combination of both. Yeah. You get these I feel like I have personally gotten these moments of clarity where my intuition is telling me to do one thing and I know for certain if I don't scratch that itch, I'm not going to be happy. And it was that moment where it was kind of a second chance at taking the European dream and placing it into action. When I fired my agent, I thought it was over. And I could hear my grandfather's voice basically telling me, hey, you need to go get a job. When I was searching for a playing opportunity in Europe, he was like in my dad's shorts about, what is your son doing? I love my grandfather dearly, but he was like 40-year vet for Caterpillar, worked at one job, engineer mindset.
Well, my parents are the same way. To this day, they're kind of like, waiting for me, I feel like, to get a real job.
And it was just like, you know, they didn't have the opportunities that we all have, and they couldn't explore those things. And so wrapping their heads around that as these ideas and ways of living are evolving right in front of us is hard. I understand it. But he was on my dad, on his ass, like, what is he doing? He's ruining his career. He should be working. You know, what is this dream he's chasing? And my dad, credit to him and my mom, they sheltered me from that. I didn't know about that until like way after I was done playing and had a conversation with him. And so for me, I had kind of given up and was giving into that, my grandfather's voice on that.
Who was in your corner still giving you or kind of back in your self-belief, or were you alone
my dad.
In that? Okay, so your dad was
My dad and my dad and my mom. If my dad was on board, my mom was on board typically.
Because I do find that, and I think I saw this on some podcast or reel at some point in the recent weeks, of like, you need, you know, self-belief is still the origin and still like the genesis of it all. But at some point, though, to really get to the realization of it, you do need that at least like one person that you can fall back on that is going to support you, whether you actually succeed in it or not. They want you to kind of pursue it. And I know, like, in a lot of ways, it's been my wife for me. And in this situation, it sounds like your dad for you.
I heard this the other day, and I think this is really true. When you look at people that have accomplished really great things in their life, they have three components. One is they have an innate ability to push themselves beyond what they think their limits are. And a lot of times that comes from choosing their enemies or their motivators really wisely. The other piece, the second piece, is that they have someone that they love or that they have loved that has treated them poorly, that they use on a chip on their shoulder, or like a way that they were slighted. And then the third thing is they have someone that unconditionally loves them and pushes them to be great. And the third part was definitely my dad. I remember when I was sitting next to him, he was going through chemotherapy. I would go and sit with him, and we had conversations that were deeper than any we had ever had because of the moment. And he said, "You realize when you went and played, you were living my dream." I'm getting chills right now thinking about it because up until that point, he had never told me.
Yeah.
Do you understand how hard that is? Like, I have kids now. To live your whole life, I was 30, and to never tell them that what they're doing is your dream and just let them live but support them, insanely difficult, because all I want to do is, number one, see my kids be successful. I talk about it with my wife. We want them to be successful in their passion.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, the strength you would have to have in the moments where you feel like maybe I was going to quit basketball. And he couldn't have any fear in his eyes. He couldn't show me resistance in those moments where I wanted to quit, dye my hair blue, grow a mohawk, and like go skateboarding. He just said you had to stay involved. But how insanely hard. And by the way, like during all the hard moments, not to tie my success to the love that he was showing me. So it's like this interesting gray area where keeping me involved, knowing what was best for me, at that time, it meant basketball and all the lessons that it taught me, but never be so connected to my interest or my success in that sport to let it waver how he treated me or the engagement that he showed. Because sometimes as a parent's like, oh my gosh, like my son's no good at the sport. Maybe we should just quit because I don't like seeing my son suck. I don't like seeing him cry. I don't like seeing him go through this difficulty. He was never like that. I just think that if you can find somebody in your corner, it can be extremely valuable, like you said, on these like inflection point moments where you say, do I trust myself enough to go? And he's like, no, yeah, you need to. Like, listen to that voice. You need to trust yourself. So he was that guy for me.
Was your dad always very open with you in a way that you didn't feel like you were, as you got older, you were able to talk to him more like man to man rather than father to son? And yeah. I say this because this is something I've thought of, and I've had a few conversations with close friends lately about it, is that I feel like I was very close with my dad growing up, and in a similar way, it was a lot of times through baseball. And he played, you know, at Longwood, was a pitcher, and then, you know, mm-hmm. I go through, and that baseball's my thing for a while. And then after I got to high school and started to shift in towards bodybuilding and lifting and kind of very much went my own route, we still have like a good relationship, but it seems like the evolution of it either got stunted or there's like a gap there mm-hmm. to where I feel like when I have conversations to him now, there's still a wall. Mm-hmm. And some of it is like, you know, it can vary from individual to individual. And, you know, he could kind of be, again, protecting a certain amount of like emotions or this or that. But I just wonder, you know, you referenced your father was getting close to passing. So I wonder if he was just a little bit more open to speaking to you in the most honest, human, kind of expressive way.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we just talked about our parents and our grandparents. I mean, they weren't used to one showing emotion, particularly men. And the gray, there was a lot of pride, and I think there still should be a lot of pride in hard work, a lot of pride on like toughness, grit, that sort of mentality. Some of that's being lost, and I think some of it can be overplayed. But our parents and my dad, he was probably as soft as one could be underneath the thumb of my grandfather, who, by the way, great man, like a lot to admire about him, but didn't leave a lot for emotion to be played. And my dad was about as emotional as one could be underneath that. And he was still like, he showed signs of like putting up a guard and not sharing when he should share. And when he got to that moment, I got to spend those individual times with him when we were trying to get him treated. I think in his mind he knew, like, not that he wasn't going to make it, but the risk of that being a possibility was just kind of like, now's the moment, let me start opening up and sharing some of what I feel like Ty needs to hear, what needs to be shared, because who knows, right?
Yeah.
Who knows what the future holds?
Yeah, and I feel like the male instinct or inability sometimes to share isn't from a place of being, you know, unempathetic or not having the emotion or not even like the desire to not want to share. It's quite possible, especially with fathers, like the fear of having the other person perceive you in a different way. It's like once they see this kind of version of you, they see this actual inner self, the inner kernel of your being, that you'll perceive them in a lesser way or in a, you know, weaker
way. Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. I don't think it's even just manifested in fathers and sons. It could be manifested in competitors. Yeah. I mean, how many, I heard this the other day too. It was basically looking at Jordan and Kobe, and they were sticking on basketball for a second, but those hyper competitors, it's like a Kobe or a Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
They never once showed vulnerability, right? Even in their most vulnerable moments, they never showed vulnerability. And it's a mask for insecurity. It's a mask for, will this be weaponized against me in some shape or form, either indirectly or directly? Whereas if I give this person a kernel of me showing weakness, how does this, number one, as a father, impact them? But number two, as a competitor, how do they see this? How do they perceive this? You know, Jordan was all about putting his foot on people's throats. Kobe was the same way.
Mm-hmm.
If he showed any amount of gray area movement, nuance, 95% instead of 100%, was someone going to take advantage of that? And I personally can see the benefit of being that way for that binary outcome, for performing, getting the most out of yourself, potentially, if you have the right team around you, getting the most out of your team. But I think holistically, it can be a pretty like kind of short-sighted, damaging quality.
Yeah, it could be a cold way to
collateral watch. Damage can be high.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it leads into a good question I wanted to ask you, since we're on the topic of fathers and obviously you're raising two beautiful kids, is what does it mean to be a father? And like, what is the role, do you think, of a father? And some of it, I guess, can overlap with kind of masculinity that we're speaking to.
Yeah. Yeah. The first part is the unconditional love.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just for your kids to know you love them. Truly. Like, no, without a shadow of a doubt, you love them. Because that amount of support when they go through the hard things in their life is going to be really important. Truly. And you don't know how important it will be until they get to that moment. And sometimes it seems like you've told them you love them a couple times today, that's enough. But sometimes as they're growing, I think they need to hear it more. And just really internalize that, like, no matter what happens, you're going to be there for them. That's the first thing, in my opinion. And I'm, by the way, I have a kid that's 4 and a kid that's 2, a boy and a girl. So I am seeing some nuance and diversity between the two, but I'm no expert, right? This is just what I've noticed in the lessons I've taken from my dad. The second thing that I would say is reduce the fake environments as much as you possibly can.
What do you mean by that?
It's getting really easy in this world to create fake environments for people. I think adults, same way.
So do you mean like not sheltering them from either challenges in relationships or from adversity in life, like not being a helicopter parent?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think particularly for dads, it's your role to keep them safe, make sure they're loved, keep them safe so they don't put themselves in like permanent harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also your role to give them space.
Mm-hmm.
They have to learn what pain is like. They have to learn what dealing with, you know, fellow students in the classroom that may hurt their feelings is like. And then you have to be there to help them work through those emotions as they happen and contextualize them.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's something, again, I feel like every time I speak to a parent on the podcast, I like to ask a similar shade of each of these questions, just because I do get some nuance with it.
Yeah.
And I think that is a good point, is that I don't know, for some reason we have this, we think that we always want or desire, let's say, like happiness or like these good feelings, but it is like a point of relativity to where, how should I put this, like, where, how do you find the right balance, I guess, of having your kid like experience these pains and these emotions, these negative experiences, mm-hmm. embarrassment, shame, humiliation, feeling bullied, but teaching them that, not that they should like not feel the anger or the pain. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
No.
Is like, we almost want to like erase a feeling. Like, for example, mm-hmm. if we feel depressed, yeah. we want to like erase the depression. We feel bored, we want to erase the boredom. We don't want to feel bad feelings because it doesn't feel good. But it's kind of like you need to lean into them to actually understand them,
yeah.
and also to find the value within them. You know, why am I angry? Why does this make me feel this way? Okay, well, what can I do with that emotion, rather than being very reactionary with it, I guess.
Yeah. I 1,000% agree with that philosophy comment. And I think that can be fostered at a very young age with your children.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it with business. I think about it with sport. I think about it with relationship. I think yeah. about it with everything in our lives, where most of the, call it the general person you run into on the street, is very quick to move through an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get through something. It's about getting through the day, getting through the week, getting through this feeling. Or men in general, we're fixers.
Mm-hmm.
And trying not to fix things, which has been a problem historically for me in my relationships, like fix things before they're ready to be fixed. Maybe it's about me sitting with the emotion as much as it is maybe the other person in the relationship. It could be a friend, it could be a teammate, it could be anything. And with our son, one of the best compliments we've gotten about him is that he advocates for himself better than any other kid his age in terms of how he's feeling. I'm feeling very frustrated right now. I need to go take a break. And he'll go sit in his room by himself, and then he'll come back down when he's ready. And we're trying to help him describe through words what Good. He's feeling in a moment.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of things that kids aren't allowed to do. They're not allowed to tell you that they're upset. Okay, what's the cutoff for crying? Is it 2 minutes? Is it 3 minutes? Is it 5 minutes? Right? Probably depends on the situation. A lot of parents are like, hey, stop crying. Or, hey, your crying in this restaurant is a reflection of me. No, it's not. Right? Like, as a parent, being able to sit with the social discomfort that comes from having kids in public settings. I mean, just think about how many families and parents get hot flashes on planes when their kid won't stop crying
mm-hmm.
because they're so embarrassed. And there's really nothing to be embarrassed about. Sure, you can be courteous and kind, but at the expense of what? The kid? Right? Like, and a baby's not going to know, but yeah, but a kid that's 4,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah, they're going to know. They're going to know, yeah, they're going to know that you're trying to move them past this emotion, that it's not okay. Like, and there's enough research, psychological research coming out to know that that's the case. And maybe a lot of us that are in middle age or growing, like, we're dealing with some of that impact now. So I think the biggest thing is try not to create fake environments for them. Expose them to situations that are going to stir up some emotions, but then doing our best as a couple, Alex and I, to help them manage that and by themselves. Because at the end of the day, here's the thing. You're doing your kid a disservice if you're trying to solve all their problems.
Yes, yes, yes.
That doesn't just relate to tying their shoes or showing up on time. It relates to managing their mind as well. And they don't know how to manage these floods of hormones going through their brain when they're getting upset. You do.
Mm-hmm.
So you can help them contextualize that really early. I mean, I take that part very, very seriously in trying to make sure that they're equipped with the tools they need to succeed with. I also will say that fake environments, we've been very fortunate, my wife and I, to have made good money, right? By some people's standards, they would say it's wealth, by others, not so much. But what comes with that is we have the ability to make our lives very easy relative to others. At what point do we cut off the ease of our life to show them and instill in them what it actually means to live in the real world?
For most people.
And that's a discussion she and I have all the time. If you would say there's one risk, that's the risk.
Mm-hmm.
That's the risk, is that through the experiences that she and I are able to afford and to offer not only ourselves but our family, that there's these lessons that are missed along the way about grounding people and the important things, the values of life, the way you treat people, So we're, you know, very adamant about watching that, because that's like one of the greater fake environments that I see happen with kids, you know?
Well, speaking of your son, I do wonder too, you know, who is Ty pre being a father and post being a father? It's like, how has having a son not just like change your habits, your behaviors? I think that's kind of like an obvious thing, right? It changes your life. But how has it kind of transfigured or like painted over your perception of the world? Like, how do you view the world and let's say your place or your importance differently now under the lens of being a parent?
It's a weird answer. Being a parent has given me more confidence in myself, because I need to have it. You know, you go through, sometimes when you're driven, like we talked a little bit in the intermission about this, being cut from a basketball team in sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be a winding answer, but I think it'll make sense to people. When you're cut from a team, when you're in sports, what that programs into you, in my belief, is this need for acceptance and admiration from outside sources. Because what you're pursuing is in direct relation of what other people think about your performance in that thing. And outside perspectives and judgment on your thing is how the world works. It's how people get paid. It's how you make teams. There is a sense of like providing value and being worthy. I get all that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have that. What I'm saying is that that should be mixed with other areas of finding value in and of you're like in yourself and confidence. And sportsmen are notorious, unless you're just one of these freaks like LeBron that really just kind of painted his own path, didn't really need anyone else's admiration because he was that guy. And there are a few athletes like that. Bo Jackson, Deion Sanders. Like, there are guys, no matter who they played for, what team they played for, they were impact guys on the field. The rest of us, I was not that guy. By the way, I didn't even play any varsity basketball until my senior year, and I averaged 5 points. And I had to work like hell to get to that position. So I was always in the camp of like doing what the coach needed me to do, making the hustle plays, being on teams. Okay, so where is he going with this story? The story is, a lot of times what that programs into you is looking over your shoulder and saying, who's watching and are they agreeing with my performance? Because I want more minutes. I want more time. I want more shots. And the gatekeeper to that is the coach, or in Europe, it was the owner. And for like Lane, when up, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it sounds like it's like less so what you can do for Lane. It's more like through, you know, reflecting back towards you, what you provide for him, you're getting that confirmation of your value and your worth.
Mm-hmm. So exactly. So when it comes to my confidence, I've been able to transition some of those external forces that used to drive me into what do I need to be for him to be successful. And when that's coming from a spot like that, I really truly don't care. I mean, the amount of care that I have for outside people or outside opinions on that factor for my son individually is virtually zero. So what it does is gives me a lot of conviction and confidence in my decisions as I'm making them in the context of him and his growth and what he needs. There are a lot of opinions on how to parent. I think a lot of differing opinions have value depending on the current situation, but it's given me confidence. How I need to show up at work, the type of little things that bother me versus the big things that I really need to be paying attention to. How am I going to be perceived if I choose to parent him in a certain way by the public versus this is exactly how I know he needs to be parented in this moment, so I'm going to parent him this way.
Yeah. How-
it's that, and it's not meaning like I'm going to spank him or be physical. Uh-huh. It just means that like maybe there are moments where I'm going to spend more time explaining an emotion to him, gentle parenting, and there are some times where he's being edgy on purpose and acting out where I just say, hey man, this isn't the way it's going
to
go.
Well, it goes back to the diet thing. There are these dogmatists with parenting too nowadays, where it's like you see, like, it's like, oh, you got to do the gentle parenting, or mm-hmm. then our parents, I'm sure, spanked the hell out of us, and yep. And you know, a good reference is like my wife never got spanked. Never. Like both of her parents were very, not because they were following gentle parenting, but they're just gentle by nature.
Right.
And so she was raised in, you know, a certain way versus me. It's like I got spanked, but I think it was valuable. It was important. Yeah. It was like that infliction of pain upon me allowed me to, you know, curb some behavior that if not curbed, it, you know, it ends up acting out as an adult.
For sure.
Which leads me to a good question, and we kind of touched on this a little bit off camera, was the what principles do you hope to instill in Lane and even your daughter as well? Although I'm sure there might be some differences from boy to girl, but you know, one point that I'll kind of lend over to you is we were discussing how do you kind of artificially instill this idea of adversity to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously you're not going to go, you know, pay someone to go bully them or anything.
Yeah, no. There's limits, yeah. People. Like, don't hang me.
Schedule a schoolyard fight for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But
keep it PG on the adversity.
Yeah. But
no
it's,
abductions.
You know, it's kind of paradoxical. It's like the greater success you have and the comfort you provide for your family, the greater you are, at least materialistically as a provider, it is harder to instill some of those, you know, values that made you who you are and that allowed you to do that for your family. How do you instill that in your kids? And I think, you know, one way that we were discussing a little bit is allowing them to kind of experience what it is for the, you know, the normal person as far as, you know, what it takes to, you know, earn things through work ethic, what it means to kind of persevere. And you get a lot of that through sports. But one thing that, you know, I think about is I had to work through high school every weekend to kind of pay for my car. And that taught me a lot of lessons versus if my parents just gave me a car, like a lot of my peers, I wouldn't look to my vehicle or look to my work with the same kind of reverence and pride. It's not even the fact that, oh, I had to work to earn this. It's more looking at the work with a sense of pride and thinking to myself, this is how things are done. This is how they're earned. This is like the expectation. So what are, I guess, ways that you kind of think about that as your son is getting older?
Yeah, I think those are all great points. It's hard.
Yeah.
I'll just say that it's hard.
Especially, I guess, when you're combated, maybe with, I don't know if you go to other, you know, birthday parties of your you know, your friends' kids, or you know, you go to preschool and maybe they look at you and they're like, oh, why is he parenting that way? I don't know if you get much pushback.
I don't get much pushback, like particularly in public. I don't think anybody would do that. I think we around reasonable people. I know some people that would do it though. I tread lightly in that conversation. It's like, look, I don't have any idea what goes on at home. I don't have any idea what like parents you grew up with, what was acceptable, what was unacceptable, and how you choose to treat your kids. I think that should generally be the thought. Now, if people are reaching out about ways to accomplish a certain thing or they're dealing with a problem with the kid, that's different, right? You have experts for that. But the general like armchair quarterback of parenting, it's just so contextual and every kid is so different. It's as nuanced as anything. For me with Lane, and I'll just speak to him because Rue's so small now, these lessons wouldn't really fall on her. But for him, I think there was a couple of things that we tried to do from a value set. Alex started something which I think is really important. So every night before he goes to bed, we do affirmations with him. And we make him say the affirmations.
It's funny because Trino said the same thing.
And he, I can't take credit for this, although we have some fun with the affirmations.
Yeah.
And so he can like navigate and change them up at the margin every night. But there's a couple of them. I am kind. I'm strong. I'm brave. I'm smart. I try really hard, which is one that I am adamant about.
Mm.
I love my family and my family loves me. And then he says his name. I'm Lane Stephen Morris. And then that's how we end the day. And I think that's just really important, man, to be doing from a really young age, is because if you can be an advocate for yourself, you don't have to rely on other people to be an advocate for you long term. So we think that's really important. So we start with the affirmations, and that kind of passes through some of the values.
Mm-hmm.
we try to celebrate the small things that he does. And what is a small thing? If I know that he's scared, today he got a flu shot. He was really scared about it, but he went through it and he made it out. I throw a party for him because he was really brave and he did something that he didn't want to do, but he still went through and it was fine. I try to celebrate as many of those as I possibly can. When he's very kind to his sister or he's being overly sharing, like, we celebrate those things big time. And so we're trying to place indirectly his attention on the things that really, really matter. And most of that is like how you're experiencing like humans in his life, how he's treating people. You know, saying please and thank you, like addressing people, looking them in the eye, like shaking hands, like all those human skills that I think are super powerful. We place a lot of importance on those things. Outcomes, not so much. If he gets like a good report or he does something at school that gets him like a gold star or whatever, I think Alex and I try to unpack that for him and say, like, why did this happen? Okay, here's an example. At gymnastics, he gets two tickets if he listens, gets one ticket if he doesn't. One ticket doesn't buy as many things as two tickets. So when he gets to the end and everybody else gets two tickets and he didn't show up that day the way that he should have shown up, we explain to him why he can't just get the thing that the two tickets would have bought because the gymnastics teacher wants to be nice.
Yeah.
Same thing happened at school. He went to school after his birthday. They had leftover cupcakes. He didn't listen to his teacher during nap time. When I picked him up from school, he's one of the last kids, and the teacher wanted to give him a cupcake. And I said, absolutely not. Like, he didn't earn a cupcake today. Dude, we had like a 30-minute conversation in the car with him crying. And it's hard as a dad. It's hard to say no. It's hard to like listen to him cry and be upset. Everybody else got a cupcake. But the lesson is, dude, you show up the way you need to show up and good things are going to happen. You don't show up the way that you should show up, not so good things are going to happen.
Yeah.
And it goes back to feeling the emotions. Like you said, you can be upset all day long, feel the feelings, but then let's contextualize the feelings and make sure that you understand them.
I like that because it's placing more of an emphasis on the intention, which on the surface level, that sounds pretty obvious and clear. But specifically what that does is it instills a sense of self-ownership and self-responsibility. Like you said, how I show up, the, you know, the rationality I put into this action, you know, again, it allows them to, again, put the onus on themselves, internalize, have that sense of introspection to understand, you know, because the outcomes, the consequences aren't always in our control, obviously.
No.
You see that in the sport world, you see it in the business world, all of that.
Yep.
But as long as you have the right intentions, okay, we can work with that. Okay, you know, so I like that. Last note on the family, and then we can get into kind of business and Leadville and all of that, is it's something we chatted about at the, well, it was actually at the trail before we went to the coffee shop a while back, was balancing, well, honestly, just the word balance itself, right? And and this perception of it, because when we spoke, and I'm sure it's probably hasn't much changed, is it's this difficulty of trying to chase our pursuits, let's say, within business or within our, you know, other pursuits, whether it's like running or whatever, making time for these different personal ambitions, but then also trying to make sure we have a fruitful, functioning relationship back at home with our spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult because they want you to kind of pursue that, right? Like if you have to sacrifice your own pursuits, then you're going to be unhappy even if you have more time with them. But if you don't have any kind of check on that, if you don't have any balance at all, then, you know, there's that sense of resentment to your partner because you're not helping fulfill their needs. Yeah. You're not providing the love, the support, the assistance with Lane. What are some of the checks that I guess you try and put in place to maintain that? Or where do you kind of, what tools do you use to measure, okay, this is where I've gone kind of too far. I'm working a little bit too much and I need to pull back.
Yeah. A lot of that for me is intuitive. And so it's being as connected as I possibly can be so I can read the signs of intuition as they come up. Because I don't think everybody wants a handbook on a lot of things in life right now. Mm-hmm. They want step by step. how you start a company. They want step-by-step how you rise through the ranks by the time you're 35 and become a millionaire. They
the
want
perfect morning routine.
Perfect morning routine. I mean,
yeah.
And there is value in that. It's not me like, it's not me shit-talking that stuff because I've used a lot of it, but it needs its proper place, which is there is no autopilot for this thing. There are going to be seasons in life where I need more attention from Alex. There are going to be seasons in life where she needs more attention from me. There are going to be seasons in life when Lane's in high school where he's going to need more attention from me.
Mm-hmm.
Where the 2 weeks ago, he didn't even want to be around dad. Now there's something that's come up at school. He got dumped. He got cut from a team. And he needs me around for that week to monitor him, right? And to be like, so as much as I want to say that there's this rule book for me, check-ins internally. If how do I feel he's doing?
Mm-hmm.
Do I feel like he's okay for me to send a few more emails, or does he need me to go sit on the couch and watch cartoons with him and just snuggle him? And it's the same with Al. I think the biggest area of growth that I have experienced that I'm still not great at by any means, but that I've experienced from being married is communication.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're straight up and you're communicating about what's going on, dude, it alleviates 80% of the issues. If you're feeling like, hey, man, I really need to go to this event. I feel like if I don't go to this event, here's what's going to happen. This is what I'm working through. And you communicate that. It's hard to be mad at that.
Mm-hmm.
If you just pull the trigger without talking, and this one of her big pet peeves, for me, I'm such a go-getter that sometimes like I'll just be like, oh, it's easy. I don't want to bother them with that decision. I'll just go execute. But dude, that hamstrings the relationship. It hamstrings the connectivity between her and the outcomes that I'm trying to have. That's the other thing, dude. You pick the right partner, they're going to help you achieve whatever you want to achieve. What do you want to go do? She's been phenomenal at traveling around the country, mm-hmm. job to job, being in my camp, supporting me. She's not a rah-rah gal. She'll tell you straight up. Like, she's not like one to write me a page-long affirmation. But her actions are what tell me everything I need to know. That she supports mm-hmm. me. Where she doesn't feel like we're connected is when I just go out, and even if I accomplish something great or there's a positive outcome, I didn't communicate or make her a part of it. That's when the problems arise. So the only checks and balances I have are like, am I using intuition? Am I like reading the signals? Am I connected?
Mm-hmm.
And what is my communication like right now? Of all the things that I have on the calendar, what have I discussed? What have I not discussed? Not in a malicious form or a hiding form, but just out of like convenience. Or, yeah, I don't have it on the calendar because I just thought I'd bop over here real quick when it was just really easy to put it on the calendar and make her aware and make her feel connected. And I just really feel like communication gets thrown around a lot, but people are really poor at it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not great at it, but if you can master that connective tissue of communication with the people that are important in your life, 80% of the problems that you have are going away because people just feel involved. And enrolled in whatever you're trying to accomplish. And that goes with spouses, in my opinion. It goes with kids. It goes with everything. You know, it's like, how much did you really know about what your dad had going on when you were growing up? As close as I was to my dad, I knew very little about mm-hmm. his job. But not having him around, I wish I would have known. I wish I would have known the days and the weeks he came home and he was kind of stressed about money. But the way that manifested itself was that he didn't have time for me. Like, just think about all the misread communication and poorly experienced situations that was just the byproduct of one person feeling away and didn't know how to communicate that way, and the other person interpreting malintent or something else.
Just through body language.
And then all of a sudden, dude, you just have this shit pot, right, of stuff to work through. So that's just, you know, kind of using intuition and communication, what I would say would be the two biggest things.
So we've kind of discussed how you spent obviously time as a professional athlete in Romania, did all that, then you had to transition into to kind of business world. I wonder if you can describe a little bit of the struggles or difficulty, if there was any, of pivoting back to kind of business world after your time mm-hmm. in Romania. Obviously, the market had changed from 2009, but there are a lot of skills, and that's one thing you speak a lot about on your platform. And what I like to hear about more is these evergreen skills that whether it is in the capital, you know, venture capitalistic world, or whether it's in fitness, or whether it's in sports, anything, these kind of universal skills. So what was that transition like, and how did these skills show up for you?
Yeah, so 2012. I forget the year. It's like 2011, 2012. I'll have to go back and look. But it was my last year in Romania. I had just rehabbed my second ACL surgery. I came back, was playing in a preseason game, and tore cartilage in the preseason game, chasing a loose ball out of bounds. And when I got up, I had known I re-tore my meniscus and that I had done some cartilage damage after the game. After you've gone through about four knee surgeries, you kind of know the way that it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking to a restaurant, our team restaurant that night, and I was like, my career's done. And we went to the doctor, and they went in there with the scope, and he said, look, you're 20, I think I was 23, 24 at the time. He said, you have the knee of like a mid-30, 40-year-old. If you continue to play at this level, you're going to do some serious damage. And so I stayed in Romania, rehabbed the back half of that third year. And during that time, I had started that journey, what you just described. How do you transition? How do you move from something that has swallowed your entire identity for as long as you can remember and transition that into something new? Where do you start? What skills do you have that are migratable? Who do you reach out to that can plug you into certain situations? And this is one of the things that I say to college kids today, like your stock will never be higher than it is today for a lot of you. A lot of you won't go out and play after this. A lot of you will have true professional careers, not sports professional careers. So take advantage. And one of the things I tried to do and I did successfully in college was I took advantage of that. So I had a big network to call on. That was the first piece. The second piece that I did was I tried, and you will find this about me, I'm huge on self-awareness. Self-awareness first. As great as you can be in self-awareness, put it this way, the better you are in self-awareness, the easier life is, because you can pick and choose your positions so much better.
Could I pause you on that?
Yeah.
What is it, how do you think of self-awareness, and how do you think that's developed within you? Because, and I'll lead it with myself, and I think this might maybe could carry you into your experience, is I think of it because I, growing up and even now, I spend a lot of time in solitude, and I value solitude, and I think it doesn't make me better than anyone else, but I mean it because I think a lot of people don't spend time in solitude. There's always background noise. They pick up their phone as soon as they get bored.
Yep.
We don't spend enough time away from screens. That's quite obvious. But I think it's through that solitude and thinking through things and having a lot of that internal dialogue, perhaps because I was more of a lone wolf or solitary man growing up. But through that, I'm able to understand a lot about myself. Mm-hmm. It goes to what we talked about with emotions, but also your desires, your ambitions. What do you want out of life? Again, as we were just talking off camera, like what I think about, like, what lifestyle do I want? I kind of sit alone by myself and visualize, like, what do I want my day to day to be? And if I didn't take that time, then I'm just blindly striving, blindly urging, following, you know, money or whatever I'm supposed to be, you know, following, yeah, as perceived by other people. Mm-hmm. So how do you instill, or how have you developed that sense of self-awareness for yourself?
I agree with everything that you just said. The first part of self-awareness is just starting to want to be self-aware.
Yeah. As plain as it sounds. Yeah.
Yeah. So how often are you challenging yourself on your own beliefs? How much are you drinking your own Kool-Aid? Mm-hmm. How much are you blaming outcomes on other people or outside circumstances versus looking internally? Like, that to me, when I was playing sports, used to be a really telltale sign. Telltale sign of ego and a telltale sign of lack of self-awareness was everything was someone else's fault. It was the coach's fault. It was the teammate's fault. And so when you start to see people describe their, like, toils in life with an external lens like that, you start to look at, like, okay, they're not aware at all about how did I contribute to the situation that I say I didn't want.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first. This is the first piece, is like to want to do it. I think there are so many self-awareness tools out there that can help you on that journey, can help you start to unpack who you are innately. I'm not saying that they are foundationally 100% accurate. Call it the Strength Finders exam or the Myers-Briggs or any of these exams that start to get to the crux of who we are, but they're directional. They're valuable at a directional level.
Yeah. Well, when I first came in, we were chatting, we talked about interest, right? How do you know something is your interest versus someone else's interest? And I see this a lot lately with, I've gotten some direct messages, and I've seen this with different people on Instagram, is where they arbitrarily come up with this sub 3 hour marathon goal, or they arbitrarily come up with some kind of goal. Like I want to do this, or I'm going to start doing that. And then after they achieve it or they do it for a while, they lose like this motivation. It's like, well, I don't think it's anything with that particular thing or you achieving the goal. I think it's a matter of you just attaching yourself and your identity to someone, to someone else's goal, because you like the outcome or like the external perception that that person is portraying on Instagram, which is just social media. And not having that self-awareness, you don't realize that you're trying to absorb someone else's interest, and assign it to yourself.
Well, the interest thing is kind of completely separate, in my opinion, to the self-awareness. I think the interest thing comes from tasting and iterating, because
because you won't know unless
You do. Man, you have to get out there and experience life and try different things and be honest with yourself about the things you like and be honest with yourself about the things you don't like. Some of that, to your point, is a bleed over from what other people like.
So it sounds like a twofold exercise then. You have to experience to have something to reflect upon.
Context,
within self-awareness.
Yeah, the frame.
Yeah, so it's like a two-step process there.
Yeah, so going back to just kind of wrap this up, so you, okay, how do you start? The first thing that I did was I took the StrengthFinder 2.0 exam. It's an incomplete tool. It's not perfect, but it's directional. So what that came back with was a number of different personality traits that were foundational to me, which I generally agreed with. Communication was high. Individualization, which as described by that exam, was my ability to see individual powers and individual people and help them work together as a team. Pursuit and achievement. Being restorative and being problem solving. Like all these things came together. And then it gives you some examples of careers that one with some of these attributes could thrive in. Again, imperfect. But when you're quitting basketball, something you've had your identity tied to for a long time, directionally powerful enough to say, yeah, maybe sales and consulting should be my first taste.
Let's start here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the market. Yeah. I see a lot of people when they're making these big transitions in life just flounder. Because there's a sea of opportunity and a sea of industry and a sea of ways they can quote unquote use their skills, and they don't end up choosing because they don't know where to start. And for me, home plate is important because it's where you start. It may not be where you end, but it's where you start. And then from there, each individual step is a data point. So how can you with quickness gather as many data points around that first decision as possible to change if it's not a fit or to double down if it is? And I think that that's a lot of it, is finding the direction at first that you're going to choose, having in your mind a why. One of my greatest mentors in business, who I worked for in capital markets when I first started post-basketball, he had this saying, he would always say it to me, which is such a great leadership mindset, but he would come to me and say, I would ask him for something. I'd say, I want to do this. I want to approach these clients this way. I want to take on this new piece of territory. I want to, and he'd say, okay, I agree with you. Now tell me why. And I think not enough people are answering the last part of that question. I agree with you. Now tell me why. So if you're going to go this direction, it's not just about I'm passionate, I'm getting my intuition, but it could be like, this is where my skill sets can play in the market right now. This is what I know about myself. And this is the first pass. This is as best a guess as any for me to start, and this is what I'm going to do. And so when I'm making that transition in anything in life now, which I've gone from basketball to capital markets to real estate developer to venture capital, when going back to evergreen skills, it goes back to self-awareness. Mm-hmm. What are the evergreen skills, which I will call the non-negotiables, that I have innately to me? Maybe I'm good at selling. Maybe I'm good at consulting. Maybe I'm good at problem solving. These things are transferable, no matter if you're a basketball player, a venture capitalist, a podcaster. Okay. So if those are where I'm starting, how do I continue to stack evergreen skills on top of evergreen skills on top of evergreen skills that make me a monster and completely transferable no matter what my industry is? That's why you see guys like a Musk, like a Bezos, like a Zuckerberg, like any of the big, like Chris Williamson, big podcaster, he just came out with a drink. Why do they have this ability to feel, even have the confidence to step into new industries? It's like you with Switchback. Mm-hmm. It's because you've developed these foundational skill sets that allow you to have the confidence to say, hey, I'm going to step in here and I'm going to be able to figure it out. Technical skills, I didn't have any technical skills in capital markets before I went into it. When I started real estate development, zero, knew nothing about it. And now in venture capital, like I've worked in it for a couple cup of coffee, but I know that I can sell. I know how to talk to people. I know how to, my work ethic is very high.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And to build off what you're saying, the evergreen skills aren't, they aren't so high level or something that you can't like start with today. They're very foundational.
Yeah, exactly.
And to allude to your point about Switchback, I would even go a step before that with opening my gym. I was 19 years old. I had no experience with owning a business, with balancing checkbooks, with buying, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of equipment, with any of this. But it was the ability to take that leap of faith. Okay. But as far as the foundational skills, through fitness, through some of the work and the grit required to do some of the jobs I'd done in the past, I was willing to work late nights. I was willing to, you know, work from 5 a.m. to 10 p.m. to close. I was willing to do these things. I did have some, again, personal skills as far as communicating with different people. I spent time as a personal trainer, so I knew exactly, you know, how to assist people in their goals, and a bit of sales skills obviously comes into that. You know, and I had spent time building on my Instagram. So there I am developing marketing skills. And again, it all falls back on the doing. So again, taking the leap and going to experience, not about where you, you know, not stressing too much about where you're going to end up, but where, you know, just starting in the first place.
Yeah.
One thing I want to, ask you about as well that you mentioned, and that I knew, I guess, immediately before we even met, is you do have a knack for networking. And so you mentioned you kind of already built this network while you were as a student in college. How do you go about that? Or at least how do you think about it, maybe even now, about trying to make sure you meet new people, finding the right people to meet, how to maintain touch with them? How do you go about building not just a network, but like a fruitful network?
Yeah, it's a good question. The opposite of what everybody thinks. It's inbound, not outbound. And maybe at the beginning it's outbound, but now it's just turned into inbound. And what I mean by that is a couple of things. When you're networking, a lot of the pressure you place on yourself as a young person is to prove that you deserve to be in the room with the people that you're networking with. You see that they have value and you want them to know that you have value as well.
Yeah.
And how that manifests itself sometimes is like a little bit pushy and a lot of talking and not a lot of listening and question asking. And one of the best skills I learned from my dad, he'd walk into Golden Corral, man, and he'd know the entire staff. I'm not shitting you. He would know the guy at the checkout. He'd know the lady that was making the steak behind
Golden Corral fanatic.
Dude, scooping the ice cream. He knew everybody. Mm-hmm. And he'd pull into the drive-thru at Boston Market. He'd be getting his mac and cheese and his mashed potatoes. He'd talk to the guy in the drive-thru holding people up behind us about his family or about the game his son just played. He would take me and drag me to high schools in the city to go watch the son of a guy that worked at a restaurant he had nothing to do with. He would go and see them. And at the time, I thought it was super annoying. But what it was teaching me subconsciously is like taking interest in people. Literally, if you just take interest in people beyond any sort of measurable benefit that you're going to get them near short, long or near term or long term, it will do wonders for your networking.
That's what I try and do in a lot of my conversations and podcasts. Just thinking about that, and it's something I could do. I could aspire to be more like your dad at the Golden Corral. But it's that idea. I'll bring on people, right? They might be, you know, crushing it with whatever business. In a way, I don't care. I want to like know what makes you tick. I want to know like all the personal ins and outs that drive you forward or make you do certain things. I want to hear why you don't eat breakfast. You know, I don't want to care. I'm not asking about, you know, the ins and outs of how you operate your business or do that or make sales. All that's valuable. I am more chasing after like the personal things, yeah. You know, I want to get down to the root of the individual.
And that's where connection happens.
Yes.
Is seeing and being seen. That's mm-hmm. all of us. We walk around with this facade. All this house that we're sitting in is a facade. It's a representation of what, number one, we enjoy, but also like all external facing things are saying something about who we are.
Yeah, carries expectations too.
For sure.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so the quicker we can cut to the chase, we can get through that. You can ask me questions about why I don't eat. I mean, I remember when I first started out in sales and capital markets, I would go into meetings in New York and I wouldn't talk about business. It'd be a 45-minute meeting. I would know everything about their family. I would know that they grew up in New York. I would know that they had a heart attack when they were 45 and they changed their way of life. Three kids, those kids are in college. Here are the colleges they go to. One plays sports, one's married. I'd leave that first meeting and that would be the detail. I'd know nothing about their business.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? Every time from then on, I asked to spend time with them. They wanted to spend time. And it was genuine. It was not a tactic or it was not like a step-by-step, grow your network this way. It's literally, how do you talk to human beings? It's one of the things that Alex Hormozi said the other day, which I do, but he put into words. It's called the ACA framework, I think. It's like, acknowledge what the person says, give them a compliment, and then ask the next question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how humans communicate and connect. But a lot of people don't do that. So for me, the networking is like, what I mean by outbound, inbound. Outbound is you have to put yourself in traffic. You're not going to be able to network by sitting at home, by being online. Nothing replaces an in-person engagement where you can look somebody in the eye, you can shake their hand, you can give them a hug.
To interrupt you, you know, it's funny. After we last met, what was it, like two months ago, whatever, we both essentially drove 40 minutes to meet in the middle. And I think we had to reschedule it a few times. Yeah. And I remember after it, I told my wife, I was like, you know, it was nothing against Ty. Like I almost didn't feel like going and like going out of my way to drive up and make the effort. But then like leaving our, you know, conversation that morning, I was like, man, I'm so glad I did that. You know, because it is like that. It's like getting out of your comfort zone, getting out of any convenience, taking the extra step, putting in the extra effort. One, it shows something to someone, whether they like inherently like, you know, or explicitly like notice it or not.
Yeah.
But it's like we both took the effort out of our day to like go and meet and you know, and had a rewarding conversation and a great time and shared some physical exertion on some miles. And again, like it's always worthwhile. It's always worthwhile, yeah, to take those extra steps.
Yeah. And so that's the first part, is the in-person. The second thing I would say to anybody looking to grow their network is, if you're asking for advice, well, let me take a step back. Don't ask for advice unless you're going to actually do something with it.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Especially young people. They're like in this thing. Well, don't ask for, you know, if you want somebody to help you, ask for advice. Don't ask for the help. Yes. But there's too much asking for advice and not enough action behind the advice. And one of the things that I saw really ruin progress for people that I've worked with, younger guys that I've worked with, is they wanted my opinion on things, but then they would literally not go and do anything with what I asked them to do. Or what I told them that I would do. And so with a lot of people networking, one of the best things you can do is say, hey, I took what you told me. This is what I did. Here was what happened. Is there any other added tactics, strategies? What would you change? This is my experience. Okay. All of us want to be like see and be seen is what I said. One of the best ways to be seen is for someone to actually take something that you've told them and put it into action.
Well, it's because they now had to stick their neck out, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one of the biggest things that I think you can do as a follow-up is, I did this. If I had more time, I would do this. This was the outcome. What would you do next? And if you do that with some key individuals within your network, they're going to be embedded in what your future success looks like. And growing your network, that is one of the most powerful things you can do. And then when I said inbound, outbound, inbound, those are outbound activities. But once you build a reputation as being interested in other people, being willing to help, it's amazing if you've done it with the right people, how much of the inbound interest starts to come. Hey, you're a person that has this connection. Maybe you can help me here. Oh, Brock, I heard you guys did a podcast. Brock told me about you. I would love to sit down and have a conversation. I had another guy that was giving me some coaching tips the other week. He has two other people underneath him that he thought could talk to me. I had two conversations with them last week, and that's kind of how the ball keeps going. Eric Hinman, who's a buddy of ours, has a thing where he wants to meet one new person each week or each day. I forget what he is.
I think it's every day.
Every day.
He's a hustler.
He's an animal. And connect to people that may not know each other every day.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a formula for it. And so you can apply that. That's a kind of like a good framework. But those would be my three things would be outbound, getting in front of people, asking more questions than you're asked, being interested. Two, if you're asking for advice, follow up with those people on real actions and iterate from there. And then three, just let kind of the motion of that energy create inbound opportunities and always take the first meeting. Mm-hmm. Always. Like you said, you didn't know if you should have driven to see me. You didn't know if it was going to be worth your time. It sounds like it was, and I'm happy that it was because I felt really good about it too.
Yeah.
But how many engagements in our life do we say, oh, dude, it's too easy to sit at home?
Yeah, well, that's what it is.
I can send this email. I can be on my computer. Like, what's really going to happen out of this meeting? I swear to you, 75% of the time, 80% of the time, I walk away feeling like you felt like I felt like that was a really good connection. And who knows where it leads.
And they're always, unique experiences and memories. It's like I can stay at home and make, today's Tuesday. It could be Tuesday. My Tuesdays look the same almost week to week, but this one won't. I'll remember this one. I'll remember this conversation and we'll look back on it. So it's, I'll have to even implement some of those things that you just referenced more and more in my life. To round off this, I want to ask you about Leadville because, I have my first big 100 coming up here in June in Bighorn.
Yep.
And after our experience at Leadville, I think there was just this heavy contagion of passion and angst and everything coming out of that where both of us left the race like, give me the sign-up sheet, and I calmed down a little bit, and also Don, my coach, kind of worked me into a different race that's a little bit more suited for me. We'll have just as great of an experience, but why Leadville, and what are some of the initial feelings or nerves going into it?
Well, why Leadville's probably, we talked about earlier in the show, Are our choices even our choices, or our decisions or our interests even our interests? I question that a lot about myself. Part of it is I've heard about Leadville more than any other 100-mile race.
It's so historic.
And it's so popular that if I'm going to pick one, why not just go for that one? I'm not as experienced of an endurance athlete as you are, so I just don't know the world as much is probably it. Like, I don't even know what my other choices are. You told me about Bighorn on our run. I'm like, I don't know what Bighorn is, but it sounds even gnarlier than Leadville, which is crazy. That's part of it. I think, as you said, walking away from Leadville and seeing the experience, being a part of it, also was just like being there. I was like, I want to experience the full thing.
Yeah, just as the crew.
Insane. It was... the camaraderie, I say you already did your podcast with Joey, but I've been telling everybody since that day, that race, it was the most inspirational environment and physical feat I've ever been a part of, like personally, live. It was just that type of energy. So I was like, yeah, I got to do it. Look, naturally, I think some of the worries are for me, will my knee hold up? I think I can train long enough and hard enough to get my body ready. It's just, will my knee hold up during training, or will my knee to hold up during the run?
Mm-hmm.
I also, 100 miles is a long time to be alone by yourself.
It is.
I've never been alone by myself, I don't think, for that amount of time. Or it's been a long time. And you're with running with other people. I get it. You're not completely alone. But that's a long time to be with your thoughts. So there's that too. But more excitement than nerves. And I'm using the same coach as you, obviously, Don. He's gonna prep me.
So if we fail, it's on him.
I think so.
Yeah.
Donnie, hearing that, dude? Yeah, I mean, this is a complete reflection of your coaching abilities.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Ty, this has been great. I'm looking forward to our run we're about to do and just spend more time with you. Where can people find you? Because you're posting a lot more content the past few months. So where can people find that information?
Instagram is Ty_Mori.
Lost the S.
lost the S. Someone needs to give the S up to me. I'm looking for Ty Morris, no underscore. So if anyone knows who that is, just tell them to come forward and just hand it over. But for now, it's Ty underscore Maury. I'm posting less industry specific stuff, just more thoughtful, evergreen
universal
skills, universal stuff that I'm experiencing. Who knows, that may change over time. And then some other exciting things coming down the line with businesses, et cetera, in the near future. But Ty underscore Maury is the best place to find me.
Awesome. I appreciate you guys listening to the episode. If you did get something out of it, please check out Ty, share the show, follow for more stuff like this, and we'll catch you guys in the next one.
Thanks, brother.